Well, Rocky Flats was a nuclear weapons facility, basically a production plant for plutonium pits or triggers for nuclear weapons. Los Alamos designed the bombs, and Rocky Flats was the production factory that literally produced more than 70,000 plutonium pits for nuclear weapons over the course of about 38 years. It's interesting to me that the people outside of Colorado who are more familiar with the nuclear weapons complex in the United States are more aware of Rocky Flats than people inside Colorado. Actually, it was a great secret due to the Cold War in the beginning, and even to the present day, there are many people who don't know about Rocky Flats. It's a shocking history of the plant, really.
But Rocky Flats was, while inescapable for you and fellow residents of your town in Colorado, it was not necessarily discussed that much. Is that correct?
Right. No one talked about Rocky Flats. Very few people knew exactly what went on there. It was operated by Dow Chemical when I was a kid, and then Rockwell, and then AG&G. And the rumor in the neighborhood was that they were making household cleaning supplies. In fact, my mother thought they were making scrubbing bubbles. And there were a lot of reasons for that secrecy, partly due to the Cold War, as I mentioned earlier. Workers were sworn to secrecy. They couldn't talk about their jobs outside of the plant. And they couldn't talk about their jobs with each other. Often workers in one area of the plant would not know what workers were doing in other areas of the plant. So that was another reason for the secrecy. And then, of course, there's always been a very strong business interest, I think, in that area. Rocky Flats is a beautiful part of the country, just outside of Boulder, Colorado, between Boulder and Denver. And the mountains are there, and the plains, and the mountains rise up from the plains, and it's beautiful. And there's a lot of real estate there, and I think home builders and other businesses were not necessarily eager, even to the present day, to let people know that that land is contaminated by Rocky Flats. So there have been a lot of reasons to keep Rocky Flats a secret.
You mentioned that employees from one department weren't allowed to talk to employees in another. When you read that, it's a head-scratcher, but considering the time when you were a kid, there was still very much a Cold War sensibility. Secrecy was not that unusual.
Exactly. And that particular policy, which was also true for other nuclear weapons facilities around the country, was called containment, and it was one way to preserve secrecy. Workers with, you know, in one area of the plant didn't necessarily know what workers in another area were doing.
As you come to find out, the idea that plutonium and very small parts of plutonium are not being contained at Rocky Flats.
Well, exactly. Plutonium is highly toxic, very dangerous material. 1/1,000,000 of a gram of plutonium can cause cancer or cause a health effect. And Rocky Flats has always had a very hard time keeping the plutonium on site. It leaked into the ground. It got into the air. It got into the groundwater, both during the production years and after. There was an incinerator associated with a plutonium processing building that burned radioactive material, and that went into the air. And then there were a number of fires at Rocky Flats, in particular, one in 1957 and one in 1969, that released a great deal of material. So even now, even though the site is closed and there's been a very controversial cleanup, 1,300 acres of the site are so profoundly contaminated and still contain so much plutonium and other radioactive and toxic material that it can never, ever open to the public. And the problem is that it's very hard to keep that material contained, to keep it on site, to keep it from preventing it from going into local neighborhoods.
I want to talk to you in a moment about when you worked at Rocky Flats, but you mentioned the fire in 1969, and you write that that was taking place while you were having brunch with your family.
Right. It was that fire happened on May 11th, 1969, and my family, like many families on that day, we were out having Sunday brunch, and we had no idea that the plutonium processing building was on fire at Rocky Flats. It turned out to be one of the costliest and most devastating industrial fires in the history of the United States. While we were having our Mother's Day brunch, there was a radioactive cloud traveling over us and the rest of the Denver metro area. There was no warning. We weren't told. We didn't know. We didn't find out until much later that it had even happened. The only thing that there was in the newspaper the following day was a very small little notice that there had been an accident at Rocky Flats, not to worry. It was buried at the back of the paper next to an advertisement for Pet of the Week. I'll never forget when I went back in my research and looked at that again. And it was very anesthetized and minimized, and so we really had no idea what had happened.
But it was a very dangerous situation, it turns out.
It was a terrible fire, and one thing that happened after the 1969 fire was that there was independent testing that proved that plutonium had escaped from the plant and was evident in local neighborhoods as far as 30 miles away from Rocky Flats. And that forced the Department of Energy and officials at Rocky Flats to admit that there was off-site contamination. But the surprise was that they admitted that it was that contamination was not from the 1969 fire necessarily, but that it was primarily from the 1957 fire, which was much worse, and no one knew about that fire. And also from more than 5,000 drums, 55-gallon drums that had been standing out in the open, filled with radioactive material, and the bottoms had rusted out and leached into the ground. And that's where most of the contamination was coming from.
You would leave the country to live in Europe for a bit, but then when you arrived back in Colorado, some years later, you're a single mother of two, and you worked at Rocky Flats.
Yes. I spent 3 years in Europe working as a travel writer, and as a kid, I didn't really know what was happening at Rocky Flats. And as I said, in our neighborhood, it wasn't really discussed. Many of the parents of my friends worked at Rocky Flats, and it was considered to be a good job, you know, great benefits, and people were really dependent upon the plant for their livelihood. I was living in Europe in 1989. When the FBI and the EPA raided the plant on June 6, 1989, which I believe is the only time in the history of this country that two government agencies have raided another. That led to a grand jury investigation, a runaway grand jury, and a very, very controversial situation. But I was in Europe, and I came back, and my marriage was falling apart. I had two kids. I was putting myself through graduate school. And they were hiring at Rocky Flats. And even then, most people did not know what was going on at Rocky Flats or what had happened during the grand jury investigation. And they had changed the name. And it was called the Rocky Flats Environmental Technology Site. So in my naivete, I thought, oh, they must have cleaned things up out there a bit. And I was very much in need of a job. And so I went to work at Rocky Flats for a while myself. And I have to say, I was also very, very curious to see what it was like to work there and to kind of get in on the inside. Rocky Flats had always been this great monolith of my childhood, of my life, and I wanted to see what it was like.
And unbeknownst to you at the time, you were working next to something like 14 metric tons of plutonium?
Yes, I was unaware of that. And the interesting thing about the situation was that my job at Rocky Flats was to meet with managers, engineers, project managers, and type up reports that went to Washington. But many of the things that I was writing about, I'm not an engineer. I have a PhD, but it's in English, not in engineering or physics. And I didn't fully understand what I was writing about. And I wasn't really that worried about it. I was, you know, there were a lot of acronyms, like MUF, for example, M-U-F. I wrote a lot about MUF. What was MUF? Well, it turns out MUF is missing unaccounted for plutonium. There was a great deal of unaccounted plutonium, that sort of thing. But it wasn't really until one evening I picked up my kids from daycare and brought them home and fed them their suppers and gave them their baths and put them to bed and came downstairs to have a cup of tea, turned on the television, and there was a Nightline program on Rocky Flats. And it was a real eye-opener. It was the first time that the public really began to see what was happening. And I was stunned. They were interviewing people that I worked with. And manager Mark Silverman was talking about 14 tons of plutonium much of it unsafely stored around the plant, and various other problems. So I was stunned, and I knew in that moment that I would quit. And the day that I quit, I knew I would someday write a book.
That someday was sometime later. As you mentioned, your PhD is not in engineering. What kind of learning curve did you have to overcome to become confident to finish the book?
Well, this book took more than 10 years. And I can say I've been thinking and writing about Rocky Flats since I was about 11 years old and writing about it in my journal. It was such a mystery to us. But from the moment that I began to seriously investigate the plant and conduct investigative journalism to try to get my heart and mind around the story as fully as possible, and I had several research assistants off and on during that time, and it took almost 12 years, really, not just to do all the research and pull all the material together and conduct interviews. I interviewed many, many people, and I also relied on hundreds of interviews at the Cold War Museum Oral History Library in Boulder, Colorado, which is wonderful, and many, many other sources, lots and lots of research. And then once I had gathered the information, I had to really step back and think about how to tell the story, because I wanted it to be a very readable story that represented all the different kinds of people whose lives have been affected by Rocky Flats, from the workers to the residents to the activists. And I wanted the book to read like a novel, and yet be true and factual. And it's very heavily footnoted, but I hope it reads like a novel, and it tells a good story. It tells a true story.
It tells a chilling story. There's one anecdote, the 903 pad.
Mm-hmm.
This was, correct me if I'm remembering this incorrectly, but you would do exercise walks, you know, as many people do. You'd get up from your desk and you would put on tennis shoes and walk about. And there was, what, a simple yellow police line that said, do not cross?
Well,
and what was go ahead, I'm sorry.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, and what was on the other side of this?
Well, this, as I was writing the book and writing this particular scene, it resonated for me in a couple of different ways. For one thing, when my sister Karma and I would often ride our horses down Indiana Street or Highway 93, some of the roads around Rocky Flats, we would ride our horses along the line and kick the signs with our cowboy boots. And we never, you know, really fully understood why we couldn't, you know, get onto the other side. Of course, that land was contaminated on that side and on our side, too, you know, the fence notwithstanding, the barbed wire fence notwithstanding. And it was kind of a similar thing with the 903 pad. The 903 pad is the area where, as I mentioned earlier, more than 5,000 barrels stood out in the open. And these were 55-gallon drums filled with liquid radioactive and toxic waste, and they stood out in the open for 11 years. The bottoms of these drums rotted and things leached out into the groundwater, and it was a huge problem for local groundwater supplies. They eventually moved most of those barrels, but the material, the soil under the barrels was still contaminated, even though they tried to cover it with asphalt and that sort of thing, and then they covered it with a tent. When I was working at Rocky Flats, and there was a great sense of camaraderie among the workers, I think, for a number of reasons, and a lot of kind of gallows humor from time to time, actually. But some of the other women and I, we would take off our heels and put on tennis shoes and walk around the plant for exercise on our lunch hour. It's a beautiful walk, a beautiful view of the mountains, a beautiful view of Denver. And we would walk past the 903 pad area. And the first time I walked past that with my colleague, I asked her, what is that? And she said, well, there's a line here. We can't go over on that side because that's very heavily contaminated. And I said, well, how does plutonium know to stay on that side of the ribbon and not come on this side? And she said, well, it knows. Don't worry about it. And, of course, that turned out not to be true, but I think that that's the kind of thing that all of us want to believe, that plutonium is something that is easily contained, and you can't see it, you can't smell it, you can't feel it, so it must be okay. That's what we would like to believe. That's not the truth of the matter.
Well, and if you read this, you can, it may not be plutonium, but all of us tend to have that sort of it's okay mentality about a lot of our life, and it's easier to live life, I think, in one way with that sort of ignorance is bliss attitude.
Right. Well, and I think especially in areas where people are so dependent upon a company like Rockwell or Dow for, you know, to make their mortgage payments, and it fuels the local economy, and so it's really hard for lots of reasons for people to accept what happened and talk about it. As I was writing this book, it was very hard for my parents, and my mother in particular, to hear about everything that had happened at the plant. For one thing, she was stunned, as all of us were, as everyone is, that we weren't more fully aware of everything that had happened there. But no parent wants to believe that they're raising their child in an unhealthy place. My parents thought that they were raising their children in an absolutely idyllic setting, and it was great. We had horses, we had dogs, we swam in the lake, you know, we were outside all the time. And we were at risk, and we didn't know it. When I worked at the plant, it was very common for the workers to refer to themselves as Cold War warriors, and many of them were proud of that. The residents, those of us who lived around the plant, we were Cold War warriors too. We were right on the front line. It's just that no one told us.
I want to go back to the term muff, M-U-F, missing, unaccounted for. Mm-hmm. And you know, in football, if you muff a punt, you kind of fumble it for a second, but then you recover it. It's sort of a not quite a bad thing. It's such a gentle term. But this is missing, unaccounted for plutonium, and in the, which is anything but a gentle subject. So much of it was in this category. Was any of it ever accounted for?
Well, the Department of Energy and Rocky Flats have various explanations as to what happened to all of that plutonium. Again, it's a remarkable figure to think about, you know, when you consider it takes just a very, very tiny amount of plutonium to cause a health effect. And here we've lost more than 3,000 pounds of it, and that is the official figure as stated by Hazel O'Leary, who was then Secretary of Energy in 1995, but that number remains firm to the present day. And the Department of Energy says that some of it was actually shipped off-site and not properly accounted for. There are administrative errors. At least 62 pounds of that, which isn't really much in the big picture, but at least 62 pounds was stuck in the ducts and the piping between the buildings. And that became apparent after the 1989 raid when the FBI went in and investigated, and they discovered that many of the filters had not been changed and they were clogged up. And in fact, sometimes workers took screwdrivers and poked holes in those filters so that the contaminated air would move more quickly. The emphasis was always on production, not safety. So that's where some of the plutonium ended up. Some of it is still out there. There are some uncertainties with respect to how much plutonium is out there and where it is and how it is stored or buried. And I think some of it ended up in my backyard, for example, and a few other people's backyards as well. There have been repeated studies that show higher rates of cancer and health effects in the area.
And when you say your backyard, you're not being metaphorical. You're not being figurative.
No.
Your backyard.
I have to tell you, one of the greatest ironies of my life is that I went to Europe to work as a travel writer, as a journalist, to look for stories, to look for things to write about, because I thought, well, I grew up in Arvada, Colorado. I grew up in suburbia. Nothing happened there. I have to go out in the world and find something to write about. And then it came back. Then I came back, and it took me a while to realize that the biggest story that I had to write was what was happening quite literally in my own backyard, in the soil of my own backyard.
Hmm. The name of the book is Full Body Burden, Growing Up in the Nuclear Shadow of Rocky Flats. Kristen, how did you know you were done with the book? All these years of research, and I'm sure it's a subject that you can always find out something more about, when did you know you were ready and it was completed?
Well, I think that it is a very timely issue for a number of reasons. I finished the book before Fukushima happened. But of course, Fukushima kind of raised everyone's awareness of these kinds of things, and that was a surprising moment for me when I came home from work one day and turned on the television, and oh my gosh, they were talking about radiation and plutonium and all the things that I'd been talking about and thinking about for so long on television. So that was a surprise for me. But I have to say, I think as a writer, you're never really done. You always want to pick up the book and edit a little bit more. But in terms of the closure of the story, coming to a sense of closure, Rocky Flats was eventually closed. It stopped producing plutonium pits in 1992. Then it remained open. In 1995, when I was working there, there was talk about cleaning it up. But the Department of Energy said that it would take $36 billion and more than 70 years to clean it up, and they didn't think that they had the technology to do it. Well, then a deal was cut with a company to do a much shorter cleanup with compromised levels of plutonium and other materials out there. So a great deal of contamination remains on site, and that site is scheduled to open as a national wildlife refuge and public recreation area for hiking and biking and possibly even hunting, even though deer and cattle and other animals have demonstrated plutonium in their bodies. And as I said, there is a great deal of contamination that remains on site. And so that really was the last. I went to visit Rocky Flats just as it was getting ready to open as a national wildlife refuge. It hasn't opened yet, but at that point they were just getting ready to. And I was filled with such a sense of outrage that this is not only something that people should be aware of before they send their child out on a field trip to the Rocky Flats Wildlife Refuge or whatever, but I was outraged that the story is so quickly being forgotten. And in Colorado, we're very eager to pretend that Rocky Flats never happened, that it doesn't exist, and we're building houses all over the place out there in highways and shopping malls right up to the edge of the site. And I felt that this was a story that cannot, should not, and cannot be forgotten.
The name of the book, again, is Full Body Burden, Growing Up in the Nuclear Shadow of Rocky Flats. You also have a website where people can learn more about the book, but you have a blog and other items there as well, right?
Yes, and there are maps, and there's a MUF chart. Speaking of MUF, there's a MUF chart. There are all sorts of information for people who want to learn more about Rocky Flats.
And that is KristenIverson.com.
Right.
And you spell your last name Iversen.
Correct. Yes. Thank you for pointing that out. People often misspell it.
Thank you so much for your time.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it.